not tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight. And man, I have a very, very special show today. The last couple of episodes, if you guys have been listening, I was talking a lot about mixing and mastering, really getting your levels straight and giving you guys some tips and tricks to use and fine-tuning your mix. And the guest I have today is the main source of what I try to mirror and follow as a producer and a little engineering. And he has mixed albums from Janet Jackson, Mary J. Blige, Bryan Adams, Sting, Mariah Carey, TLC, Rod Stewart, and Boyz II Men. Everybody put your hands together for Grammy Award winning engineer, Steve Hodge, to Producer's Corner. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, man. Good to be here.
Oh, man, pleasure. Now, Steve, give us a little background of, you know, when you began to move into the engineering side of music. I don't know if you're a musician, but, you know, what prompted you to get into the engineering field?
Well, I was a musician as a very young man, and I was a songwriter as well, and was pursuing an artist career, actually, and I had some connections in the music business. I had two of my uncles were both famous engineers, actually, of the 40s, 50s, and 60s on into the 80s. And one of those kind gentlemen was nice enough to give me a job at his studio while I was waiting to have an audition with the label that he worked for. And I had the audition with the label, but I really enjoyed the engineering side of things and ended up sticking with that, actually. And that's where it started. That was back in 1969.
Oh, wow.
My 40th year in the business.
Wow, amazing. What did you play?
I was a guitar player, singer-songwriter. We did do a demo, which turned into a one-song career. That song was sold to a movie, actually. It was supposed to be the featured piece of what was going to be an album, but I got so into the engineering side of it, I pretty much forgot about the artist side, and never did any other recordings after that first song.
Wow, amazing. Well, you know, which brings me up to my next question for you. You know, listening the way you mix and the albums that you've recorded and engineered, to me, you know, the way I hear it, I really feel that you listen to it and you mix like a musician, a producer. You know, for me, I like to have every instrument that I have in my mix. I want it to have its own place, its own tone, where it's not bouncing and taking away from the other tracks that I have within my mix. And listening to the way your ear is, man, it's just every instrument that I listen to, every track that I've heard that you've done, it has its own place, and it just fits like a glove. And, you know, I don't know if it's the musical side that's coming into when you're mixing, or, you know, how you put it together, but it's really balanced, and it's really nice.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, that has a lot to do with it. Every mixer, every engineer comes to the business with a background. A lot of us are previous musicians. Some of us are previous business people. Some of us are previous tech heads, design guys. And that background tends to really shine in the work you do. And as a musician, with not much interest really in, you know, how a box works. I have a lot more interest in what it makes something sound like and how I can use it as a tool.
Sure.
To get the end that I'm looking for. And I do approach everything from a musical standpoint.
No, I like I said, it's definitely noticeable. You know, you've mixed a lot of R&B track. Are you a big fan of R&B, or is it just kind of where the business led you?
Yep, I was always a big fan of R&B. I was a big fan of music in general. As an artist, I was actually more of a folk singer, protest singer back in the 60s. But I always loved R&B. My background is actually, on my mother's side of the family, we're Puerto Rican. My father's side of the family is actually native Californians going back several generations.
Oh, wow.
Growing up, I listened to a lot of big band, but I also listened to a lot of salsa and a lot of Latin music. I don't know, you're kind of a combination of those two things. R&B sort of meets right in the middle of those.
Yeah.
So I really had an ear for it, and when I found myself working with some R&B clients early on in my career, it just was a perfect fit stylistically in the way that I hear music. And I quickly became known as an R&B engineer and mixer in the 70s and 80s, early 80s in particular, before synthesizers. Being an R&B engineer was one of the most challenging things to do in the music business. It was big sessions all the time, big rhythm sections, big string and horn sections. Everything had big arrangements. It was a lot of fun. And also very complicated vocal arrangements for the most part.
Right, definitely. Now, we can't talk about R&B, man, without bringing up the two collaborators that you've worked with over the last couple of years, man, for a while. Mr. Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, mm-hmm. Minneapolis' homegrown talent.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, man, as far as their production. They definitely had a format and a formula that's been very successful, and it still is. Everything they do, it's just hot. What was it like, man, engineering those type of albums and really getting into the groove bass tracks that they have in their music?
Well, it's great. Again, you know, it's a really great fit for me because musically, our style was basically a really aggressive, driving bottom end and beat with a really memorable and beautiful melodic element over the top. That's why we did had so many successes with Janet. Her voice just fit that formula to the T.
Yeah.
And they, we would tailor everything. Jimmy Terry would tailor everything to try to fit the artist, and they were very good at that as well. But at the same time, everything did have a signature flight time sound, and that was part of their sensibilities and how they put the music together. But I think it was also a big part of it was the fact that we worked with the same crew for 20 plus years. I mixed the vast majority of the records and oversaw the recording of all of them, which kept a continuity to that flight time sound.
Oh, definitely, man. Sonically, again, this is just my opinion, those, all of the Janis albums are probably the best mixed albums I've heard sonically. On top of having heavy production, like I said, the mix just stood out, especially vocally. The way it was mixed, the way the drums were mixed, the way everything was placed. What was your typical signal chain for vocals, your keyboards, and the drums? What type of processing did you use on those albums?
Well, as far as the tracks varied over the years, but the vocal processing actually pretty much stayed the same. The first thing I did was I tried to create a signature sound vocally by not recording our vocals the same way everybody else did. So it started from the very first step of the process. So I would record when we were at the Flight Time Studios, I used the AKG tube mic. And I always set that mic up in an omnidirectional pattern. Most other engineers, if not everybody else, works in a cardioid pattern. They like that close-up
right.
Proximity effect sound. So to do something different, and also because I'm not a big fan of the proximity effect sound, actually. I like a little more air in vocals in particular. It helps them to stand out away from the mix, especially when you've got a lot of mids and low mids going on that you want to get going on in the mix.
Sure.
Having a lighter air your vocal to start with made sense to me. So the first thing we did was recorded all the vocals in that way. Then mixed down. Also, I'm very conservative when I'm recording vocals. Keep the compression to a minimum, EQ to a minimum. I want a good, clean, unedited vocal sound to tape back in those days, now to into the box in these days.
Yeah.
Then the mix chain would always be a real similar thing. I loved George Massenburg's EQs. I always have.
Oh yeah. Good old vintage gear.
Yep. I had a chance to work with George back at Westlake Audio many years ago and learned a lot of stuff from him, especially when it came to EQ and high end. So I'd always use George's EQs. We had the Massenburg EQ. So I'd usually do a little compression and maybe a little bit of EQ at the console, but definitely all the high-end EQ would come from the Massenburg Parametric.
Now, what type of mic pre's did you use? Were any mic pre's, or is it just running through the compression?
We did a couple of different things over the years. We were almost always using an outboard mic pre of one kind or another. We had the Avalon box when those were popular.
737.
I liked the older Neve mic pre.
Yeah.
We had a prepackaged or a repackaged pair of Neve Mic Pres. I'm terrible with equipment numbers, so I can't remember which heck ones they were.
Sure.
It was the old Neve stuff, and I really loved that kind of edge they gave things. And I used those quite a bit.
You know, I don't have any experience with the Neve. More of an Avalon. I have a lot of experience with the Avalon 737s with the built-in compression EQ.
Yep. Those things were real popular for a while, and I grabbed a couple of those for the studio, and we did use them quite a bit. I preferred the Neve boxes. The problem with that old vintage gear is just, you know, keeping it in top shape, and especially when you're not in L.A. or New York or Nashville, where it's a little tougher to find guys who know how to work with that stuff.
Right.
But I did like to use that, and we did use it a fair amount. A lot of times we've used the Avalon.
Now, Jimmy John and Terry Lewis's production is really heavy synth-driven, especially a lot of their earlier works and through their mid-90s and early 2000 careers. Yeah. Were there any signal processing done in any of the keyboards or modules?
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy was great at getting sounds that could live, you know, from the original recording right through the finished mix. And his secret was he would use the sounds that nobody else used, which was the basic preset.
Right.
So we had a running deal with a couple of the different music supply houses here in town. They would provide us with the brand new synths as they came in. Jimmy would go through all the presets, write down the ones that he liked, and we'd go with that. We did very little editing of the presets. Most of the time, if you liked the effects that were in the presets, we'd leave them on. If we didn't, we'd take them off. And then in mixdown, we would use a lot of a stereo harmonizer technique to give the synth sounds the pads and the even some of the percussive stuff, but not much stuff, but just to spread it out.
Sure.
Stereo harmonizer means you take one side and put it a little sharp on one side and a little flat on the other side, you get a little chorus effect.
That
helps to give a little some depth to synthesizers especially.
Nice. Now I got to talk about the drums because Jam had heavy, heavy percussion.
Yep.
And rhythm section. I know there was major processing and editing going on those, man. Give me some of the tips, because that's a whole other show in itself. So just give me a little brief description of, you know, what the process was in building those drums and make them pop like they did.
Well, again, you know, it's trying to find your own sound, and the first thing to do when you're finding your own sound is maybe don't do it the same way everybody else does it. So the first thing that Jimmy did was originally a drummer, not a keyboard player, so he had a great sense for percussion and for drums. We stayed away from sequencing. Jimmy would come up with a couple of patterns in a drum machine or a drum program, and he would manually switch those patterns back and forth as he played a scratch synth track, and then we would manually play fills and other things over the top.
So everything was being recorded in real time?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
We never sequenced anything. Now, everything was to a set tempo because he was just switching patterns back and forth.
Sure.
But all the fills and all that stuff was always played in real time. So we tried to keep a live feel inside the machine world. And then from a processing standpoint, and mixdown, like I said, of course, it varied, but the basic object of the game for me was always to try to make them hitting as hard as evenly possible. On
right.
The bottom end, it's always difficult because trying to control the bottom end so that it doesn't completely dominate the level structure of the mix and still have it be big and hit is a challenge. So some judicious compression, EQ that usually takes a lot of the low mids out of the bass drum and those things down there to give it a little more space to live.
Yeah, which brings up a good point. Yeah, I found a lot of times when I'm listening to a lot of non-commercial CDs, maybe independent artists, battling those lows where you still have your bass line audible and your kick isn't drowning out, and they're kind of off tune together, where they're clashing, and I think that's probably the most difficult part for a lot of guys that are starting on mix and really balancing that out.
Yeah, and it's hard. It takes a lot of work. And then the other thing to always remember is that those low-end elements are usually a couple of the first things that you start to build when you're mixing. just remember that as you put other elements into the mix, that relationship changes as the new elements that you add mask the ones that are already in there. So you're constantly having to reevaluate. So that fantastic bass drum and bass sound that you had before you put in the vocals and the strings and the horns is not so main. Not be so fantastic once all that stuff gets on top of it.
Right.
So a big part of mixing is never settling, always going back to the things that you started with and reevaluating them and making them fit into the mix.
Now, how many pairs of reference speakers did you usually try it out when you got your pre-production mix, it's clean. Did you ever take it to another system to evaluate to see how it pounds, or you kind of just stayed in the studio?
A little bit. I as a mixer, I kind of try to avoid that a little bit. I know a lot of my pals that do what I do do that a lot. They get in their car, listen home, listen to them, you know, in their friend systems. I try to stay out of that just to keep my head clear, and I trust the producers I'm working with and the artists. I know they're going to be doing that. So when they come back with me with a comment, well, you know, it's really the bottom end is just it's way out of hand in my car.
Right.
And I'll take another listen with that in mind and maybe see if there's something I'm missing there, or if maybe their car is one of those cars you can hear coming from 5 miles away.
Sure, yeah.
But in the studio, back in the day, during the golden days over at Flight Time, we had NS10s like everybody else. We also had the big monitors in the wall. I didn't use those much mixing. And then we also used a pair of Westlake Audio monitors. They were BBS M4s, which are really nice little speakers.
Yeah.
They were a really good complement to the NS10s. Had a little more bottom end, a little more top end. The NS10s were more of a mid-range reference.
You know what I like about the NS10s? They're really good flat monitors. Mm-hmm. So it's really not that misleading when you're listening to it. I mean, what's coming out, I mean, that's usually how it should play back on most systems.
Yep, and that's, you know, there've been, having done this as long as I have, there have been speaker fads over the eons. There was the Oratones, there was the JBLs.
Yeah.
JBL 4311s were big for a while. The NS10s have hung a hard and heavy. It's been a popular speaker for a very long time. Of course, you can't get the original ones anymore.
No, they got a new newer model that came out.
Newer model. I haven't heard those yet.
Well, my church, we bought a pair from my church just for referencing and just doing some small mixes. And they're pretty decent. Not the NS10s, but they're cool.
Yeah. I still listen to NS10s from time to time, but most of the time now I work on Mackie 824s.
Oh, those are nice.
Yeah, I love those.
Those are the 8s, right?
Yeah.
Yep, nice. Now, you've been mixing a very long time, Steve. I definitely want to talk about your analog experience and crossing over to the digital realm, the DAW systems. Give me your dislikes and give me the positives out of it also.
Well, I'm one of those guys that really has no negatives on the changeover. I had a lot of problems with the analog world. There was some things that I liked about it for sure, but a lot of the compromises in the analog world always bother me. Mainly transient loss, going from the way the drums sounded in the room and on microphones to the speakers, to the way drums sounded when you played them back off of audio tape. There's just not the dynamic response on audio tape to get all the transients back. Now, a lot of my pals love tape compression. They like the way that it cuts a little bit of the transient off. Starts the compression process.
Right.
I never liked that. Again, just a completely a personal thing. So when digital came out and I actually got back over the speakers, closer to what was out in the studio, to me that was a big improvement, especially as the digital world has evolved and converters have gotten much better. So I actually, at the later days of Flight Time, I had no problem shutting the tape machines off.
Sure.
But the plug-in world was another story. Early plug-ins were not so fantastic. So
yeah.
Using a lot of still using all the same outboard gear and, of course, an analog console over at Flight Time. As plugins have gotten better in the digital world, I've made a complete change there as well, and now I don't use anything analog anymore. Once music is in the box and numbers, I keep it numbers. the next time that it gets converted is when you play it at home.
Sure, definitely.
And that's what I personally I feel is the best sound for me and gives me the most advantage to do what I like to do. To me, the biggest disadvantage in the recording studio these days is having to go through those back and forth through converters.
Now, let's talk a little bit about converters. For those of you who aren't familiar with converters, and if you're using a digital audio card, you should understand what a converter is. My terminology, how I look at it, is as easy as bringing a layman's term is, it's almost like feeding a computer their translation of audio, how it's played in, and the better converters are going to give you the exact sound of how it's played in. Now, if you have a prosumer or a lower end type of conversion, you're going to almost get broken English. It's close, but it's not exactly, and you know, start losing the mid, start losing the bottom end, and next thing you know, it sounds like a totally different sound that you inputted the signal. What type of converters do you stand by for recording? Apogee or?
I really love the DigiDesign 192s. I think that those they're fantastic. I've listened to a few other of that generation, couple of others in various other studios, that names escape me for the moment. But I just don't hear enough, or I don't hear any difference, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
You can get into the next place to look for me for an advantage on converters is in mastering, especially the way mastering is done these days. If you're going to get into mastering, then you need to take a look at the kind of converters that they use. Again, I'm sorry, but I'm not good with names. Names escape me. But you're looking for converters that do a great job of what's called soft clipping. In mastering these days, unfortunately, we've gotten into this ridiculous volume war, and you have to overdrive your converters if you want to put out a mastered record with a competitive level.
Sure.
And so you want converters that are designed to do that silly thing.
Nice.
The 192s do an okay job of it, and they're fine for trying to master up your mix a little bit for your clients so that they can AB it with their favorite commercial stuff, and it's not in two different level worlds. But if you want to master professionally, then you can take a look at the higher end stuff.
Sure.
For mixing and what I do, again, I'm not going back through the converters. The only way I'm going back through the converters is as a monitoring source, and as a monitoring source, the 192s and the whole Pro Tools system, the way it has evolved, is fantastic.
So would you bounce down to CD or Master CD or?
I don't even go there anymore. Everybody wants everything over the net now. So,
yeah, bounce it down to an MP3 or WAV file.
When my mix is done, I record it right back into the session on the stereo track. Then I can export that as files in whatever format the clients would like it. Initially, I'm always sending MP3s out over email for people to judge the mixes. These days, it's going to end up in MP3s most of the time, so that's a very valid way to judge your mix. If it doesn't work as an MP3, you got a real problem.
No, I agree. Because even if you get down to a lower bit ratio, it should still come in pretty decent clear.
Sure.
You know,
it
shouldn't sound like an AM radio station, you know.
No, because, most people are going to listen to it on earbuds, MP3s on earbuds with iPods.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're going to do any cross-referencing, by the way, you definitely got to listen to that.
No, I agree. No, definitely. Now, give me some of your current projects, any of your upcoming projects you want to put out there, Mr. Hodge, and share us with.
I have slowed down a good bit. Like I said, I've been doing this for a very long time. My main focus right now is I'm the program chair over at IPR.
Nice.
I run the production and engineering department. I teach the advanced mixing and mastering class over there, and then this quarter I've actually started teaching a career opportunities class for the first quarter students. Fantastic school, great place. And then at the same time, last year I actually did a lot of stuff, but this year I've taken a bunch of my outside work off the docket. And I'm just working on one project at alternative rock band here in town called Dropping Daylight.
Okay.
It's going to be their second album. Their first album was released on Octone, if I remember correctly. And they wanted to do an album themselves. I've always been a big fan of the band, so I agreed to do it. We're actually in the mix stage now. I'm really excited about that project. I think it's going to do really well.
Very good.
And then we're also still working a bit with a group called New Medicine. They've had several different names, but we've been working with them since they were just starting high school.
Oh, wow.
Now they're all hitting 2021. They just got signed by a subsidiary of Atlantic Records, and they're about to put out their first record, so we're still helping them through the process.
Wow.
And coming up, who knows? If something comes up that interests me, I'll take it, but these days I really don't get involved in anything that doesn't make me excited on an artistic level.
No, definitely. Got to stay true to the game, true to yourself. I always preach that, man. Well, Steve Hodge, man, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, sir, and sharing, you know, with your knowledge and experience as an engineering. And like I say, man, being a producer, I definitely feel it's a necessity to have that, also the little bit of engineering background, so you can really tailor and shape your sound for your tracks and your artists. And man, you did a tremendous job with me. Just give me some tips and tutorials to follow along with everybody else that's listening. So you definitely have another spot here if you want to come back and chop it up with me again. I would love to have you back.
Let me know.
Sounds good, Steve.
All right, buddy.
Thanks for calling.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye.
And shout out to Steve Hodge, man, for coming in and chopping it up with me on the Producer's Quarter, man. That was real hot and real informative for everybody that's really mixing and mastering their own material. A lot of you guys got your own DAW systems now, man, and, you know, don't have the funds to go to a major recording studio, you know, but it's still nice to be hands-on and get the background and feel of what level should be and how they should be coming in. So having Steve Hodge on the show, I thought was just really beneficial, and just to see what goes on within a mix, you know, from the start to the mid to post production of the mix. So, you know, again, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, man, they've had so many hits over the years. But again, I feel sonically, man, they're probably one of the best sounding albums I've heard in R&B, you know. So having, you know, the man behind the mix come on the show and, you know, share some of his techniques and secrets, and obtaining that great mix, man, was just really beneficial and informative for everybody, man. So again, thank you to Steve Hodge, you know, for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. And for those of you that would like a little bit more information on Steve Hodge and to take a look at his bio, man, he has a lot of information on his website, which is really hot, man, and that's located at www.stevehodge.com. And he also has some links to some of the interviews that he's done in the magazines like EQ and Mix Magazine, man. I've read all of them. And, you know, if you guys are picking up quick some tips and directions you can really take your mix, man, that's a really good source to really check out what he's done. And I know that's something that you should definitely be able to add to your arsenal. Like I say, if you're coming into mixing, you definitely want to keep an open mind and read everything that's available to you, just to see there's, you know, there are other ways and different approaches to getting a good mix. And even in the beginning stages and even towards the advanced stages, man, a lot of it too is trial and error, and referencing it on different systems just to make sure they match and sound good. And for those of you that like to contact me for questions and suggestions, hit me up at my new website, man. I got a really hot website that's available for musicians, producers, and engineers, man. And you can create your own profile, add your music, your videos, and join in on discussions I'll be hosting on the forum. I have a music forum that's on there for hardware synths, software synths, mixing engineering, your influences, posting up some of your influences from YouTube, man. I got a couple of YouTube links up there with some of my biggest inspiration in music, man, and it was just really hot to make it available so I could join in and have my music camp under me, man, and so we can just help each other out and network with the best of them out there. And again, that website is www.spudtootight.ning.com. And I want to thank everybody for listening and tuning in, man, and being a part of this music journey I'm on, man. And, you know, I'm real big on focusing on the music, man, and having these industry vets interview with me, man. It's just been really phenomenal. So I just want to thank everybody out there for tuning in, and stay tuned for some upcoming shows, man. I got some hot ones for you guys. Until next time, you guys be good. Peace.